and was low. Langdon tried to fix this, but strange things kept happening. Figuring out why became something of an obsession. After a while, Langdon sold his house in New York and moved to Arizona, so that he could experiment on the ocean full-time. Although the effects of acidification are generally expressed in terms of pH, there's another way to look at what's going on that's just as important, to many organisms probably more important, and this is in terms of a property of seawater known, rather cumbersomely, as the saturation state with respect to calcium carbonate, or alternatively, the saturation state with respect to aragonite. Calcium carbonate comes in two different forms, depending on its crystal structure. Aragonite, which is the form corals manufacture, is the more soluble variety. The saturation state is determined by a complicated chemical formula. Essentially, it's a measure of the concentration of calcium and carbonate ions floating around. When CO2 dissolves in water, it forms carbonic acid, H2CO3, which effectively eats carbonate ions, thus lowering the saturation state. When Langdon showed up at Biosphere 2, the prevailing view among marine biologists was that corals did not much care about the saturation state, as long as it remained above 1. Below 1, water is undersaturated and calcium carbonate dissolves. Based on what he was seeing, Langdon became convinced that corals did care about saturation state. Indeed, they cared about it deeply. To test his hypothesis, Langdon employed a straightforward, if time-consuming, procedure. Conditions in the ocean would be varied, and small colonies of corals, which were attached to little tiles, would be periodically lifted out of the water and weighed. If the colony was putting on weight, it would show that it was growing, adding more mass through calcification. The experiment took more than 3 years to complete and yielded more than 1,000 measurements. It revealed a more or less linear relationship between the growth rate of the corals and the saturation state of the water. Corals grew fastest at an aragonite saturation state of 5, slower at 4, and still slower at 3. At a level of 2, they basically quit building, like frustrated contractors throwing up their hands. In the artificial world of Biosphere 2, the implications of this discovery were interesting. In the real world, Biosphere 1, they were rather more worrisome. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, all of the world's major reefs could be found in water with an aragonite saturation state between 4 and 5. Today, there's almost no place left on the planet where the saturation state is above 4, and if current emissions trends continue, by 2060, there will be no regions left above 3.5. By 2100, none will remain above 3. As saturation levels fall, the energy required for calcification will increase, and calcification rates will decline. Eventually, saturation levels may drop so low that corals quit calcifying altogether. But long before that point, they will be in trouble. This is because, out in the real world, reefs are constantly being eaten away at by fish and sea urchins and burrowing worms. They are also being battered by waves and storms, like the one that created One Tree. Thus, just to hold their own, reefs must always be growing. "It's like a tree with bugs," Langdon once told me. "It needs to grow pretty quickly, just to stay even." Langdon published his results in 2000. At that point, many marine biologists were skeptical, in no small part, it seems, because of his association with the discredited Biosphere Project. Langdon spent another 2 years redoing his experiments, this time with even tighter controls. The findings were the same. In the meantime, other researchers launched their own studies. These two confirmed Langdon's discovery. Reef-building corals are sensitive to the saturation state. This has now been shown in dozens more lab studies and also on an actual reef. A few years ago, Langdon and some colleagues conducted an experiment on a stretch of reef near a volcanic vent system off Papua New Guinea. The experiment, modeled on Hall Spencer's work at Castello Arganese, again used the volcanic vents as a natural source of acidification. As the saturation state of the water dropped, coral diversity plunged. Coralline algae declined even more drastically, an ominous sign, since coralline algae act like a kind of reef glue, cementing the structure together. Seagrass, meanwhile, thrived. A few decades ago, I myself would have thought it ridiculous to imagine that reefs might have a limited lifespan. J.E.N. Verrin, former chief scientist of the Australian Institute of Marine Science, has written, "Yet here I am today, humbled to have spent the most productive scientific years of my life around the rich wonders of the underwater world, and utterly convinced that they will not be there for our children's children to enjoy." A recent study by a team of Australian researchers found that coral cover in the Great Barrier Reef has declined by 50% just in the last 30 years. Not long before their trip to One Tree, Caldera and some of the other members of his team published a paper assessing the future of corals using both computer models and data gathered in the field. The paper concluded that if current emissions trends continue, within the next 50 years or so, all coral reefs will cease to grow and start to dissolve. In between trips out over the reef to collect samples, the scientists at One Tree did a lot of snorkeling. The group's preferred spot was about a half mile offshore, on the opposite side of the island from DK-13, and getting there meant cajoling Graham, the station manager, into taking out the boat, something that he did only with reluctance and a fair amount of grumbling. Some of the scientists who had dived all over, in the Philippines, in Indonesia, in the Caribbean, and in the South Pacific, told me that the snorkeling at One Tree was about as good as it gets. I found this easy to believe. The first time I jumped off the boat and looked down at the swirl of life beneath me, it felt unreal, as if I'd swum into the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau. Schools of small fish were followed by schools of larger fish, which were followed by sharks. Huge rays glided by, trailed by turtles the size of bathtubs. I tried to keep a mental list of what I'd seen, but it was like trying to catalog a dream. After each outing, I spent hours looking through a huge volume called The Fishes of the Great Barrier Reef and the Coral Sea. Among the fish that I think I may have spotted were tiger sharks, lemon sharks, gray reef sharks, blue spine unicorn fish, yellow boxfish, spotted boxfish, conspicuous angelfish, barrier reef anemone fish, barrier reef chromis, minifin parrotfish, Pacific longnose parrotfish, somber sweetlips, four-spot herring, yellowfin tuna, common dolphinfish, deceiver fangblenny, yellow-spotted sawtail, barred rabbitfish, blunt-headed wrasse, and striped cleaner wrasse. Reefs are often compared to rainforests, and in terms of the sheer variety of life, the comparison is apt. Choose just about any group you like, and the numbers are staggering. An Australian researcher once broke apart a volleyball-sized chunk of coral and found living inside of it more than 1,400 polychaete worms belonging to 103 different species. More recently, American researchers cracked open chunks of coral to look for crustaceans. In a square meter's worth collected near Heron Island, they found representatives of more than 100 species, and in a similar-sized sample, collected at the northern tip of the Great Barrier Reef, they found representatives of more than 120. It is estimated that at least 500,000 and possibly as many as 9 million species spend at least part of their lives on coral reefs. This diversity is all the more astonishing in light of the underlying conditions. Tropical waters tend to be low in nutrients, like nitrogen and phosphorus, which are crucial to most forms of life. This has to do with what's called the thermal structure of the water column, and it's why tropical waters are often so beautifully clear. As a consequence, the seas in the tropics should be barren, the aqueous equivalent of deserts. Reefs are thus not just underwater rainforests. They are rainforests in a marine Sahara. The first person to be perplexed by this incongruity was Darwin, and it has since become known as Darwin's paradox. Darwin's paradox has never been entirely resolved, but one key to the puzzle seems to be recycling. Reefs, or really reef creatures, have developed a fantastically efficient system by which nutrients are passed from one class of organisms to another, as at a giant bazaar. Corals are the main players in this complex system of exchange, and at the same time, they provide the platform that makes the trading possible. Without them, there's just more watery desert. Corals build the architecture of the ecosystem, Caldera told me, so it's pretty clear if they go, the whole ecosystem goes. One of the Israeli scientists, Jack Silverman, put it to me this way. If you don't have a building, where are the tenants going to go? Reefs have come and gone several times in the past, and their remains crop up in all sorts of unlikely places. The ruins of reefs from the Triassic, for example, can now be found towering thousands of feet above sea level in the Austrian Alps. The Guadalupe Mountains in West Texas are what's left of reefs from the Permian period that were elevated in an episode of tectonic compression about 80 million years ago. Reefs from the Silurian period can be seen in northern Greenland. All these ancient reefs consist of limestone, but the creatures that created them were quite different. Among the organisms that built reefs in the Cretaceous were enormous bivalves known as rudists. In the Silurian, reef builders included sponge-like creatures called stromatoporoids, or stroms for short. In the Devonian, reefs were constructed by rugose corals, which grew in the shape of horns, and tabulate corals, which grew in the shape of honeycombs. Both rugose corals and tabulate corals were only distantly related to today's scleractinian corals, and both orders died out in the Great Extinction at the end of the Permian. This extinction shows up in the geologic record as, among other things, a reef gap, a period of about 10 million years when reefs went missing altogether. Reef gaps also occurred after the late Devonian and the late Triassic extinctions, and in each of these cases, it also took millions of years for reef construction to resume. This correlation has prompted some scientists to argue that reef building as an enterprise must be particularly vulnerable to environmental change. Yet another paradox, since reef building is also one of the oldest enterprises on Earth. Ocean acidification is, of course, not the only threat reefs are under. Indeed, in some parts of the world, reefs probably will not last long enough for ocean acidification to finish them off. The roster of perils includes, but is not limited to, overfishing, which promotes the growth of algae that compete with corals, agricultural runoff, which also encourages algae growth, deforestation, which leads to siltation and reduces water clarity, and dynamite fishing, whose destructive potential would seem to be self-explanatory. All of these stresses make corals susceptible to pathogens. White band disease is a bacterial infection that, as the name suggests, produces a band of white necrotic tissue. It afflicts two species of Caribbean coral, Acropora palmata, commonly known as elkhorn coral, and Acropora cervicornis, staghorn coral, which until recently were the dominant reef builders in the region. The disease has so ravaged the two species that both are now listed as critically endangered by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Meanwhile, coral cover in the Caribbean has in recent decades declined by close to 80%. Finally, and perhaps most significant on the list of hazards, is climate change, ocean acidification's equally evil twin. Tropical reefs need warmth, but when water temperatures rise too high, trouble ensues. The reasons for this have to do with the fact that reef-building corals lead double lives. Each individual polyp is an animal, and at the same time, a host for microscopic plants known as zooxanthellae. The zooxanthellae produce carbohydrates via photosynthesis, and the polyps harvest these carbohydrates, much as farmers harvest corn. Once water temperatures rise past a certain point, that temperature varies by location and also by species, the symbiotic relation between the corals and their tenants breaks down. The zooxanthellae begin to produce dangerous concentrations of oxygen radicals, and the polyps respond, desperately and often self-defeatingly, by expelling them. Without the zooxanthellae, which are the source of their fantastic colors, the corals appear to turn white. This is the phenomenon that's become known as coral bleaching. Bleached colonies stop growing, and, if the damage is severe enough, die. There were major bleaching events in 1998, 2005, and 2010, and the frequency and intensity of such events are expected to increase as global temperatures climb. A study of more than 800 reef-building coral species, published in Science in 2008, found a third of them to be in danger of extinction, largely as a result of rising ocean temperatures. This has made stony corals one of the most endangered groups on the planet. The proportion of coral species ranked as threatened, the study noted, exceeds that of most terrestrial animal groups, apart from amphibians. Islands are worlds in miniature, or, as the writer David Quammen observed, almost a caricature of nature's full complexity. By this account, one tree is a caricature of a caricature. The whole place is less than 750 feet long and 500 feet wide, yet hundreds of scientists have worked there, drawn to it in many cases by its very diminutiveness. In the 1970s, a trio of Australian scientists set about producing a complete biological census of the island. They spent the better part of 3 years living in tents and cataloging every single plant and animal species they could find, including trees, 3 species, grasses, 4 species, birds, 29 species, flies, 90 species, and mites, 102 species. The island, they discovered, has no resident mammals, unless you count the scientists themselves, or a pig that was once brought over and kept in a cage until it was barbecued. The monograph that ensued from this research ran to 400 pages. It opened with a poem attesting to the charms of the tiny key. An island slumbering, clasped in a shimmering circlet of waters turquoise and blue, guarding her jewel from the pounding surf on her coral rim. On my last day at One Tree, no snorkeling trips were planned, so I decided to try to walk across the island, an exercise that should have taken about 15 minutes. Not very far into my journey, I ran into Graham, the station manager, a rangy man with bright blue eyes, ginger-colored hair, and a walrus mustache. Graham looked to me like he would have made an excellent pirate. We fell into walking and talking together, and as we wandered along, Graham kept picking up bits of plastic that the waves had carried to One Tree. The cap of a bottle, a scrap of insulation, probably from a ship's door, a stretch of PVC pipe. He had a whole collection of these bits of flotsam, which he displayed in a wire cage. The point of the exhibit, he told me, was to demonstrate to visitors what our race is doing. Graham offered to show me how the research station actually functioned, and so we threaded our way behind the cabins and the labs toward the island's midsection. It was breeding season, and everywhere we walked there were birds strutting around, screaming, bridled terns which are black on top and white on their chests, lesser crested terns which are gray with black and white faces, and black noddies which have a patch of white on their heads. I could see why humans had had such an easy time killing off nesting seabirds. The terns seemed completely unafraid, and were so much underfoot, it took an effort not to step on them. Graham brought me to see the photovoltaic panels that provide the research station with power, and the tanks for collecting rain to supply it with water. The tanks were mounted on a platform, and from it we could look over the tops of the island's trees. According to my very rough calculations, these numbered around 500. They seemed to be growing directly out of the rubble, like flagpoles. Just beyond the edge of the platform, Graham pointed out a bridled tern that was pecking at a black noddy chick. Soon the chick was dead. "She won't eat him," he predicted, and he was right. The bridled tern walked away from the chick, who shortly thereafter was consumed by a gull. Graham was philosophical about the episode, versions of which he had obviously seen many times. It would keep the island's bird population from outstripping its resources. That night was the first night of Hanukkah. For the holiday, someone had crafted a menorah out of a tree branch and strapped two candles onto it with duct tape. Lighted out on the beach, the makeshift menorah sent shadows skittering across the rubble. Dinner that evening was kangaroo meat, which I found surprisingly tasty, but which, the Israelis noted, was distinctly not kosher. Later, I set out for DK-13 with a postdoc named Kenny Schneider. By this point, the tides had crept forward by more than 2 hours, so Schneider and I were scheduled to arrive at the site a few minutes before midnight. Schneider had made the journey before, but still hadn't quite mastered the workings of the GPS unit. About halfway there, we found that we had wandered off the prescribed route. The water was soon up to our chests. This made walking that much slower and more difficult, and the tide was now coming in. A variety of anxious thoughts ran through my mind. Would we be able to swim back to the station? Would we even be able to figure out the right direction to swim in? Would we finally settle the Fiji question? Long after we were supposed to, Schneider and I spotted the yellow buoy of DK-13. We filled the sampling bottles and headed back. I was struck again by the extraordinary stars and the lightless horizon. I also felt, as I had several times at One Tree, the incongruity of my position. The reason I'd come to the Great Barrier Reef was to write about the scale of human influence, and yet Schneider and I seemed very, very small in the unbroken dark. Like the Jews, the corals of the Great Barrier Reef observe a lunar calendar. Once a year, after a full moon at the start of the austral summer, they engage in what's known as mass spawning, a kind of synchronized group sex. I was told that the mass spawning was a spectacle not to be missed, and so I planned my trip to Australia accordingly. For the most part, corals are extremely chaste. They reproduce asexually, by budding. The annual spawning is thus a rare opportunity to, genetically speaking, mix things up. Most spawners are hermaphrodites, meaning that a single polyp produces both eggs and sperm, all wrapped together in a convenient little bundle. No one knows exactly how corals synchronize their spawning, but they are believed to respond to both light and temperature. In the build-up to the big night, the mass spawning always occurs after sundown, the corals begin to set, which might be thought of as the sclerectinian version of going into labor. The egg-sperm bundles start to bulge out from the polyps, and the whole colony develops what looks like goosebumps. Back on Heron Island, some Australian researchers had set up an elaborate nursery so they could study the event. They had gathered up colonies of some of the most common species on the reef, including Acropora millepora, which, as one of the scientists put it to me, functions as the lab rat of the coral world, and were raising them in tanks. Acropora millepora produces a colony that looks like a cluster of tiny Christmas trees. No one was allowed to go near the tanks with a flashlight for fear that it would upset the coral's internal clocks. Instead, everyone was wearing special red headlamps. With a borrowed headlamp, I could see the egg sperm bundles straining against the polyp's transparent tissue. The bundles were pink and resembled glass beads. The head of the team, a researcher named Selena Ward from the University of Queensland, bustled around the tanks of gravid corals like an obstetrician preparing for a delivery. She told me that each bundle held somewhere between 20 and 40 eggs and probably thousands of sperm. Not long after they were released, the bundles would break open and spill their gametes, which, if they managed to find partners, would result in tiny pink larvae. As soon as the corals in her tank spawned, Ward was planning to scoop up the bundles and subject them to different levels of acidification. She had been studying the effects of acidification on spawning for the past several years, and her results suggested that lower saturation levels led to significant declines in fertilization. Saturation levels also affected larval development and settlement, the process by which coral larvae drop out of the water column, attach themselves to something solid, and start producing new colonies. Broadly speaking, all our results have been negative so far, Ward told me. If we continue the way we are, without making dramatic changes to our carbon emissions immediately, I think we're looking at a situation where, in the future, what we've got at best is remnant patches of corals. Later that night, some of the other researchers at Heron Island, including the graduate students who were trying to weld together the overdue mesocosm, heard that Ward's corals were getting ready to spawn and organized a nocturnal snorkel. This was a much more elaborate affair than the snorkeling trips at One Tree, complete with wetsuits and underwater lights. There wasn't enough equipment for everyone to go at once, so we went in two shifts. I was in the first, and initially I was disappointed because nothing seemed to be happening. Then, after a while, I noticed a few corals releasing their bundles. Almost immediately, countless others followed. The scene resembled a blizzard in the Alps, only in reverse. The water filled with streams of pink beads floating toward the surface, like snow falling upward. Iridescent worms appeared to eat the bundles, producing an eerie glow, and a slick of mauve began to form on the surface. When my shift was over, I reluctantly climbed out of the water and handed over my light. Chapter 8. The Forest and the Trees. Alsati verticillata. Trees are stunning, Miles Solman was saying. They are very beautiful. It's true they take a little more appreciation. You walk into a forest and the first thing you notice is, that's a big tree. Or, that's a tall tree. But when you start to think about their life history, about everything that goes into getting a tree to that spot, it's really neat. It's kind of like wine. Once you start to understand it, it becomes more intriguing. We were standing in eastern Peru, at the edge of the Andes, on top of a 12,000-foot-high mountain, where, in fact, there were no trees, just scrub, and somewhat incongruously, a dozen or so cows, eyeing us suspiciously. The sun was sinking, and with it the temperature, but the view in the orange glow of evening was extraordinary. To the east was the ribbon of the Alto Madre de Dios River, which flows into the Beni River, which flows into the Madeira River, which eventually meets the Amazon. Spread out before us was Manu National Park, one of the world's great biodiversity hotspots. in your field of vision is one out of every 9 bird species on the planet, Silman told me. Just in our plots alone, we have over 1,000 species of trees. Silman and I, and several of Silman's Peruvian graduate students, had just arrived on the mountaintop, having set out that morning from the city of Cusco. As the crow flies, the distance we'd traveled was only about 50 miles, but the trip had taken us an entire day of driving along serpentine dirt roads. The roads wound past villages made of mud brick and fields perched at improbable angles, and women in colorful skirts and brown felt hats, carrying babies in slings on their backs. At the largest of the towns, we'd stopped to have lunch and purchase provisions for a 4-day hike. These included bread and cheese, and a shopping bag's worth of coca leaves that Silman had bought for the equivalent of about $2. Standing on the mountaintop, Silman told me that the trail we were going to take down the following morning was often used by coca peddlers walking up. The cocaleros carried the leaves from the valleys where they are grown to high Andean villages of the sort we'd just passed, and the trail had been used for this purpose since the days of the conquistadors. Silman, who teaches at Wake Forest University, calls himself a forest ecologist, though he also answers to the title tropical ecologist, community ecologist, or conservation biologist. He began his career thinking about how forest communities are put together and whether they tend to remain stable over time. This led him to look at the ways the climate in the tropics had changed in the past, which led him, naturally enough, to look into how it is projected to change in the future. What he learned inspired him to establish the series of tree plots that we are about to visit. Each of Silman's plots, there are 17 in all, sits at a different elevation and hence has a different average annual temperature. In the mega-diverse world of Manu, this means that each plot represents a slice of a fundamentally different forest community. In the popular imagination, global warming is mostly seen as a threat to cold-loving species, and there are good reasons for this. As the world warms, the poles will be transformed. In the Arctic, perennial sea ice covers just half the area it did 30 years ago, and 30 years from now, it may well be gone entirely. Obviously, any animal that depends on the ice, ringed seals say, or polar bears, is going to be hard-pressed as it melts away. But global warming is going to have just as great an impact, indeed, according to Silman, an even greater impact, in the tropics. The reasons for this are somewhat more complicated, but they start with the fact that the tropics are where most species actually live. Consider for a moment the following purely hypothetical journey. You are standing on the North Pole one fine spring day. There is, for the moment, still plenty of ice at the pole, so there's no danger of falling through. You start to walk, or better yet, ski. Because there is only one direction to move in, you have to go south, but you have 360 meridians to choose from. Perhaps, like me, you live in the Berkshires and are headed to the Andes, so you decide that you will follow the 73rd meridian west. You ski and ski, and finally, about 500 miles from the pole, you reach Ellesmere Island. All this time, of course, you will not have seen a tree or a land plant of any kind, since you are traveling across the Arctic Ocean. On Ellesmere, you will still not see any trees, at least not any that are recognizable as such. The only woody plant that grows on the island is the Arctic willow, which reaches no higher than your ankle. The writer Barry Lopez has noted that if you spend much time wandering around the Arctic, you eventually realize that you are standing on top of a forest. As you continue south, you cross the Nares Strait. Getting around now is becoming more complicated, but we'll leave that aside. Then traverse the westernmost tip of Greenland, cross Baffin Bay, and reach Baffin Island. On Baffin, there is also nothing that would really qualify as a tree, though several species of willow can be found, growing in knots close to the ground. Finally, and you are now roughly 2,000 miles into your journey, you reach the Ungava Peninsula in northern Quebec. Still, you are north of the tree line, but if you keep walking for another 250 miles or so, you will reach the edge of the boreal forest. Canada's boreal forest is huge. It stretches across almost 1 billion acres and represents roughly 1/4 of all the intact forest that remains on Earth. But diversity in the boreal forest is low. Across Canada's 1 billion acres of it, you will find only about 20 species of tree, including black spruce, white birch, and balsam fir. Once you enter the United States, tree diversity will begin slowly to tick up. In Vermont, you'll hit the eastern deciduous forest, which once covered almost half the country, but today remains only in patches, most of them second growth. Vermont has something like 50 species of native trees, Massachusetts around 55. North Carolina, which lies slightly to the west of your path, has more than 200 species. Although the 73rd meridian misses Central America altogether, it's worth noting that tiny Belize, which is about the size of New Jersey, has some 700 native tree species. The 73rd meridian crosses the equator in Colombia, then slices through bits of Venezuela, Peru, and Brazil, before entering Peru again. At around 13 degrees south latitude, it passes to the west of Silman's tree plots. In his plots, which collectively have an area roughly the size of Manhattan's Fort Tryon Park, the diversity is staggering. 1,035 tree species have been counted there, roughly 50 times as many as in all of Canada's boreal forest. And what holds for the trees also holds for birds and butterflies and frogs and fungi, and just about any other group you can think of, though not, interestingly enough, for aphids. As a general rule, the variety of life is most impoverished at the poles and richest at low latitudes. This pattern is referred to in the scientific literature as the latitudinal diversity gradient, or LDG, and it was noted already by the German naturalist Alexander von Humboldt, who was amazed by the biological splendors of the tropics, which offer a spectacle as varied as the azure vault of the heavens. The verdant carpet which a luxuriant flora spreads over the surface of the earth is not woven equally in all parts, Humboldt wrote, after returning from South America in 1804. Organic development and abundance of vitality gradually increase from the poles towards the equator. More than 2 centuries later, why this should be the case is still not known, though more than 30 theories have been advanced to explain the phenomenon. One theory holds that more species live in the tropics because the evolutionary clock there ticks faster. Just as farmers can produce more harvests per year at lower latitudes, organisms can produce more generations. The greater the number of generations, the higher the chances of genetic mutations. The higher the chances of mutations, the greater the likelihood that new species will emerge. A slightly different but related theory has it that higher temperatures in and of themselves lead to higher mutation rates. A second theory posits that the tropics hold more species because tropical species are finicky. According to this line of reasoning, what's important about the tropics is that temperatures there are relatively stable. Thus, tropical organisms tend to possess relatively narrow thermal tolerances, and even slight climatic differences caused, say, by hills or valleys, can constitute insuperable barriers. A famous paper on this subject is titled, Why Mountain Passes Are Higher in the Tropics. Populations are thus more easily isolated, and speciation ensues. Yet another theory centers on history. According to this account, the most salient fact about the tropics is that they are old. A version of the Amazon rainforest has existed for many millions of years, since before there even was an Amazon. Thus, in the tropics, there's been lots of time for diversity to, as it were, accumulate. By contrast, as recently as 20,000 years ago, nearly all of Canada was covered by ice a mile thick. So was much of New England, meaning that every species of tree now found in Nova Scotia, or Ontario, or Vermont, or New Hampshire, is a migrant that's arrived, or returned, just in the last several thousand years. The diversity as a function of time theory was first advanced by Darwin's rival, or if you prefer, co-discoverer, Alfred Russel Wallace, who observed that in the tropics, evolution has had a fair chance, while in glaciated regions, it has had countless difficulties thrown in its way. The following morning, we all crawled out of our sleeping bags early to see the sunrise. Overnight, clouds had rolled in from the Amazon basin, and we watched them from above as they turned first pink and then flaming orange. In the chilly dawn, we packed up our gear and headed down the trail. "Pick out a leaf with an interesting shape," Soman instructed me once we'd descended into the cloud forest. "You'll see it for a few hundred meters, and then it will be gone. That's it. That's the tree's entire range." Soman was carrying a 2-foot-long machete, which he used to hack away at the undergrowth. Occasionally, he waved it in the air to point out something interesting, a spray of tiny white orchids with flowers no bigger than a grain of rice, a plant in the blueberry family with vivid red berries, a parasitic shrub with bright orange flowers. One of Soman's graduate students, William Farfan Rios, handed me a leaf the size of a dinner plate. "This is a new species," he said. Along the trail, Soman and his students have found 30 species of trees new to science. Just this grove of discoveries represents half again as many species as in Canada's boreal forest. And there are another 300 species that they suspect may be new, but that have yet to be formally classified. What's more, they've discovered an entirely new genus. "That's not like finding another kind of oak or another kind of hickory," Soman observed. "It's like finding oak or hickory." Leaves from trees in the genus had been sent to a specialist at the University of California, Davis, but unfortunately, he had died before figuring out where on the taxonomic tree to stick the new branch. Although it was winter in the Andes and the height of the dry season, the trail was muddy and slick. It had worn a deep channel into the mountainside, so that as we walked along, the ground was at eye level. At various points, trees had grown across the top, and the channel became a tunnel. The first tunnel we hit was dark and dank, and dripping with fine rootlets. Later tunnels were longer and darker, and even in the middle of the day required a headlamp to navigate. Often I felt as if I'd entered into a very grim fairy tale. We passed Plot 1, elevation 11,320 feet, but did not stop there. Plot 2, elevation 10,500 feet, had been recently scoured by a landslide. This pleased Soman because he was interested to see what sort of trees would recolonize it. The farther we descended, the denser the forest became. The trees were not just trees. They were more like botanical gardens, covered with ferns and orchids and bromeliads, and strung with lianas. In some spots, the vegetation was so thick that soil mats had formed above the ground, and these had sprouted plants of their own, forests in the air. With nearly every available patch of light and bit of space occupied, the competition for resources was evidently fierce, and it almost seemed possible to watch natural selection in action, daily and hourly, scrutinizing every variation, even the slightest. Another theory of why the tropics are so diverse is that greater competition has pushed species to become more specialized, and more specialists can coexist in the same amount of space. I could hear birds calling, but only rarely could I spot them. It was difficult to see the animals for the trees. Somewhere around Plot 3, elevation 9,680 feet, Silman pulled out the shopping bag full of coca leaves. He and his students were carrying what seemed to me to be a ridiculous amount of heavy stuff. A bag of apples, a bag of oranges, a 700-page bird book, a 900-page plant book, an iPad, bottles of benzene, a can of spray paint, a wheel of cheese, a bottle of rum. Coca, Silman told me, made a heavy pack feel lighter. It also staved off hunger, alleviated aches and pains, and helped counter altitude sickness. I had been given little to carry besides my own gear. Still, anything that would lighten my pack seemed worth trying. I took a handful of leaves and a pinch of baking soda. Baking soda, or some other alkaline substance, is necessary for coca to have its pharmaceutical effect. The leaves were leathery and tasted like old books. Soon my lips grew numb, and my aches and pains began to fade. An hour or two later, I was back for more. Many times since have I wished for that shopping bag. In the early afternoon, we reached a small, soggy clearing where I was informed we were going to spend the night. This was the edge of Plot 4, elevation 8,860 feet. Silman and his students had often camped there before, sometimes for weeks at a stretch. The clearing was strewn with bromeliads that had been pulled down and gnawed upon. Silman identified those as the leavings of a spectacled bear. The spectacled bear, also known as the Andean bear, is South America's last surviving bear. It is black or dark brown with beige around its eyes, and it lives mainly off plants. I hadn't realized that there were bears in the Andes, and I couldn't help thinking of Paddington, arriving in London from deepest, darkest Peru. Each of Silman's 17 tree plots is 2.5 acres, and the plots are arranged along a ridge, a bit like buttons on a cloak. They run from the top of the ridge all the way down to the Amazon basin, which is pretty much at sea level. In the plots, someone, Silman or one of his graduate students, has tagged every single tree over 4 inches in diameter. Those trees have been measured, identified by species, and given a number. Plot 4 has 777 trees over 4 inches, and these belong to 60 different species. Silman and his students were preparing to recensus the plots, a project that was expected to take several months. All the trees that had already been tagged would have to be remeasured, and any tree that had shown up or died since the last count would have to be added or subtracted. There were long Talmudic discussions, conducted partly in English and partly in Spanish, about how exactly the recensus should be conducted. One of the few that I could follow centered on asymmetry. A tree trunk is not perfectly circular, so depending on how you orient the calipers when you're measuring, you'll get a different diameter. Eventually, it was decided that the calipers should be oriented with their fixed jaw on a dot spray painted on every tree in red. Owing to the differences in elevation, each of Silman's plots had a different average annual temperature. For example, in Plot 4, the average is 53 degrees. In Plot 3, which is about 800 feet higher, it's 51 degrees, and in Plot 5, which is about 800 feet lower, it's 56 degrees. Because tropical species tend to have narrow thermal ranges, these temperature differences translate into a high rate of turnover. Trees that are abundant in one plot may be missing entirely from the next one down or up. Some of the dominants have the narrowest altitudinal range, Silman told me. This suggests that what makes them such good competitors in this range makes them not so good outside of it. In plot 4, for example, 90% of the tree species are different from those species found in plot 1, which is only about 2,500 feet higher. Silman first laid out the plots in 2003. His idea was to keep coming back, year after year, decade after decade, to see what happened. How would the trees respond to climate change? One possibility, what might be called the Burnham Wood scenario, was that the trees in each zone would start moving upslope. Of course, trees can't actually move, but they can do the next best thing, which is to disperse seeds that grow into new trees. Under this scenario, species now found in plot 4 would, as the climate warmed, start appearing higher upslope in plot 3, while plot 3's would appear in plot 2, and so on. Silman and his students completed the first recensus in 2007. Silman thought of the effort as part of his long-term project and couldn't imagine that much of interest would be found after just 4 years. But one of his postdocs, Kenneth Feely, insisted on sifting through all the data anyway. Feely's work revealed that the forest was already, measurably, in motion. There are various ways to calculate migration rates, for instance, by the number of trees, or alternatively, by their mass. Feely grouped the trees by genus. Very roughly speaking, he found that global warming was driving the average genus up the mountain at a rate of 8 feet per year. But he also found the average masked a surprising range of response. Like cliques of kids at recess, different trees were behaving in wildly different ways. Take, for example, trees in the genus Scheflera. Scheflera, which is part of the ginseng family, has palmately compound leaves. These are arrayed around a central point, the way your fingers are arranged around your palm. One member of the group, Scheflera arboricola, from Taiwan, commonly known as the dwarf umbrella tree, is often grown as a houseplant. Trees in Scheflera, Feely found, were practically hyperactive. They were racing up the ridge at the astonishing rate of nearly 100 feet a year. On the opposite extreme were trees in the genus Ilex. These have alternate leaves that are usually glossy, with spiky or serrated edges. The genus includes Ilex aquifolium, which is native to Europe and known to Americans as Christmas holly. The trees in Ilex were like kids who spend recess sprawled out on a bench. While Scheflera was sprinting upslope, Ilex was just sitting there, more or less inert. Any species or group of species that can't cope with some variation in temperatures is not a species or group whose fate we need be concerned about right now, because it no longer exists. Everywhere on the surface of the Earth, temperatures fluctuate. They fluctuate from day to night and from season to season. Even in the tropics, where the difference between winter and summer is minimal, temperatures can vary significantly between the rainy and the dry seasons. Organisms have developed all sorts of ways of dealing with these variations. They hibernate or estivate or migrate. They dissipate heat through panting or conserve it by growing thicker coats of fur. Honeybees warm themselves by contracting the muscles in their thorax. Wood storks cool off by defecating on their own legs. In very hot weather, wood storks may excrete on their legs as often as once a minute. Over the lifetime of a species, on the order of 1 million years, longer-term temperature changes, changes in climate, come into play. For the last 40 million years or so, the Earth has been in a general cooling phase. It's not entirely clear why this is so, but one theory has it that the uplift of the Himalayas exposed vast expanses of rock to chemical weathering, and this in turn led to a drawdown of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. At the start of this long cooling phase, in the late Eocene, the world was so warm there was almost no ice on the planet. By around 35 million years ago, Global temperatures had declined enough that glaciers began to form on Antarctica. By 3 million years ago, temperatures had dropped to the point that the Arctic too froze over and a permanent ice cap formed. Then, about 2.5 million years ago, at the start of the Pleistocene epoch, the world entered a period of recurring glaciations. Huge ice sheets advanced across the northern hemisphere, only to melt away again some 100,000 years later. Even after the idea of ice ages was generally accepted, it was first proposed in the 1830s by Louis Agassiz, a protege of Cuvier, no one could explain how such an astonishing process could take place. In 1898, Wallace observed that some of the most acute and powerful intellects of our day have exerted their ingenuity on the problem, but so far, altogether in vain. It would take another 3/4 of a century for the question to be resolved. It is now generally believed that ice ages are initiated by small changes in the Earth's orbit, caused by, among other things, the gravitational tug of Jupiter and Saturn. These changes alter the distribution of sunlight across different latitudes at different times of year. When the amount of light hitting the far northern latitudes in summer approaches a minimum, snow begins to build up there. This initiates a feedback cycle that causes atmospheric carbon dioxide levels to drop. Temperatures fall, which leads more ice to build up, and so on. After a while, the orbital cycle enters a new phase, and the feedback loop begins to run in reverse. The ice starts to melt, global CO2 levels rise, and the ice melts back farther. During the Pleistocene, this freeze-thaw pattern was repeated some 20 times with world-altering effects. So great was the amount of water tied up in ice during each glacial episode that sea levels dropped by some 300 feet, and the sheer weight of the sheets was enough to depress the crust of the Earth, pushing it down into the mantle. In places like northern Britain and Sweden, the process of rebound from the last glaciation is still going on. How did the plants and animals of the Pleistocene cope with these temperature swings? According to Darwin, they did so by moving. In On the Origin of Species, he describes vast continental-scale migrations. As the cold came on, and as each more southern zone became fitted for Arctic beings, and ill-fitted for their former more temperate inhabitants, the latter would be supplanted and Arctic productions would take their places. As the warmth returned, the Arctic forms would retreat northward, closely followed up in their retreat by the productions of the more temperate regions. Darwin's account has since been confirmed by all sorts of physical traces. Researchers studying ancient beetle casings, for example, have found that during the ice ages, even tiny insects migrated thousands of miles to track the climate. To name just one of these, Tachinus salatus is a small, dullish brown beetle that today lives in the mountains, west of Ulaanbaatar, in Mongolia. During the last glacial period, it was common in England. In its magnitude, the temperature change projected for the coming century is roughly the same as the temperature swings of the ice ages. If current emissions trends continue, the Andes are expected to warm by as much as 9 degrees. But if the magnitude of the change is similar, the rate is not. And once again, rate is key. Warming today is taking place at least 10 times faster than it did at the end of the last glaciation, and at the end of all those glaciations that preceded it. To keep up, organisms will have to migrate, or otherwise adapt, at least 10 times more quickly. In Silman's plots, only the most fleet-footed or rooted trees, like the hyperactive genus Scheflera, are keeping pace with rising temperatures. How many species overall will be capable of moving fast enough remains an open question, though, as Silman pointed out to me, in the coming decades, we are probably going to learn the answer, whether we want to or not. Manu National Park, where Silman's plots are laid out, sits in the southeastern corner of Peru, near the country's borders with Bolivia and Brazil.